I am not using AI artwork.
So someone you love is an anarchist, and it's gift-giving season, and you realize that giving them that gift certificate to BetterHelp or maybe those Facebook camera goggles would result in them never speaking to you again. Maybe you're the anarchist, and this is a gift for yourself, and that's totally fine. Everybody deserves a little bit of self-care, regardless of why you're here. I'm here to help.
And when I say anarchist, I'm not talking about somebody who live-action roleplays The Purge every day of their lives. Anarchism is formally defined as a philosophy that resists institutions that perpetuate authority, coercion, or hierarchy. And all of the things that I'm about to show you in this video are closely related to that philosophy. So if you were expecting a DIY recipe for C4, or the best way to burn down banks, that's still a few months out. But if you're interested in a $40 solar lawn light that connects you to a 100% free nationwide decentralized messaging network, or maybe an inexpensive way that you can pull imaging data directly from satellites and take a space selfie, or a tiny device that detects nearby flock safety cameras, or maybe a $20 device that you can modify to let you know when ICE or law enforcement are tracking you via your mobile phone. And if that and a whole bunch of other goodies pique your interest, then take a seat, you're going to want to stick around, and you might even learn a little bit about anarchism in the process. Let's go. When making a video about a subject or a philosophy, I like to start at the beginning. And this is why anarchism is so fascinating to think about, because its beginning precedes all political or government ideas. Animals are anarchists. A fox can hunt rabbits in Arizona and bring them home to its den in Mexico. All children are anarchists. When you bring a five-year-old to a store, they choose not to steal a toy by weighing domestic and social consequences, not because they're afraid of their state incarcerating them. So in some ways, explaining the origin of anarchism would be a bit like explaining the origin of hunger or infatuation or envy. A valid argument is that we are all born as anarchists, and we spend our lives being manipulated into appealing to authority. Because if individuals didn't recognize authority, there would be no passive route to tremendous levels of power and wealth. For example, if you took Mark Zuckerberg with his $230 billion of private wealth and locked him in a room with every Croatian with their combined $230 billion of purchasing power parity, and if you ordered a gigantic pizza for everyone, I don't think that Mark would be able to convince the other 3.8 million people in the room that half of the pizza is rightfully his. But outside of this hypothetical pizza party, through our hierarchical and institutionalized lenses, most of us recognize the absurd idea that Zuck is as valuable as everyone and everything in Croatia. Which then begs the question, why doesn't Mark Zuckerberg just buy Croatia and make it his private residence? And this is where we'd revert back to our anarchist firmware, because I'd assume that most Croatians value their homes more than they value hierarchical institutions. We gotta start this off with what is about the most obvious anarchist-friendly tech that everybody should be using, while an alarmingly small amount of people even know about. Meshtastic. I'll get a little bit more technical in a bit, but Meshtastic, which kind of sounds like a subscription service that would sponsor this video, is the polar opposite of that. It is a freely available, completely decentralized mesh network that uses radio signals for encrypted messaging. And generally speaking, the more people who use it, the more robust and far-reaching and reliable it gets. You don't need an internet connection, you don't need a SIM card, you don't need a license or any type of subscription or registration to anything whatsoever. There are sexy standalone devices like this LilyGo e-ink message and plenty of other options, but most people just use something like this, which you can connect via Bluetooth on your phone or computer. And the cost of entry for Meshtastic is about $25 to $40 if you're ordering off of Amazon, and as little as $10 if you're willing to wait for the slow boat to arrive from China. Maybe you don't have a single anarchist bone in your body. You have WhatsApp and text messaging, and you get a data signal just about everywhere you go. Why the hell would you need Meshtastic? Allow me to answer that question with an example. If you look at the Meshtastic network to see the nodes that you can connect to, you'll notice that this is a very popular trend in North Carolina and that part of the East Coast. That's because last year, unfortunately, Hurricane Helene quickly demonstrated the need for off-grid communication, and people who had Meshtastic devices were using the network to help organize aid for their communities and find out what was going on. The idea that at $30 investment could keep you in touch with not only friends and family members, but the outside world in the event that a catastrophe knocks out power or connectivity isn't exactly prepper shit. Realistically, in that setting, it's more useful than a weather radio. And while there are seemingly unlimited amounts of Meshtastic hardware options out there, I'm going to be making two of them. The first is a simple lawn solar light that acts as a connectable Meshtastic node that I'll spend a total of $30 to $40 on. And the other is a solar-powered community base station or repeater node that I'll
I'll spend a little over $100 on. Okay, so how this all works, explained as quickly as possible, starting from the very bottom and working our way up using my favorite thing in the world, stupid metaphors.
How Meshtastic works in 90 seconds.
Light waves are a form of electromagnetic waves, and we can only see a tiny fraction of them. And the light in this video is between 400 and 800 terahertz, but way down in the gigahertz range, you're getting your cell phone or Wi-Fi signal enabling you to watch this video. Now let's slow down the frequency of those waves to 915 megahertz, which is 915 million of these lumps and dips per second. Okay, so you may know that if you have a harp or a guitar or some type of string instrument and you play the same frequency of the strings, it'll start vibrating and ringing out on its own. Well, that's resonance, and that's exactly what's happening when electromagnetic waves of a certain frequency hit an appropriately sized antenna. And by demodulating ones and zeros from those waves, we can get digital radio, broadcast television, mobile data, and of course, Meshtastic. Now imagine that you have a walkie-talkie and your friend has another walkie-talkie all the way across the country. The radio waves on the walkie-talkie frequency are going to die out long before they get anywhere close to your friend, so that's obviously not going to work. But what if you, your friend, and 10,000 other walkie-talkie users all over the country were on the same frequency, accepting and rebroadcasting all of the data being transmitted on it? If you only send encrypted text or location messages on this gigantic mesh of users that only your friend can decode, well, that's exactly what Meshtastic is. And it's completely free. You keep the network up and running through participation. I only want to build mesh communicators that will work indefinitely, so being solar powered is an obvious way to accomplish this. And a gentleman by the name of Travis Gustafson showed off a Meshtastic node that operated within a cheap solar lawn light, so that's the perfect place to start. So I picked up a Rack Wiseblock bare circuit board and a few different types of solar lights to experiment, and everything else was just spare parts around my lab. It seems like most of this stuff can be crammed into the solar panel itself, so in most cases, you don't even need to use the lamp. It's not even necessary. Unsurprisingly, there's a rechargeable 18650 flashlight battery powering the thing, which gives us 3.7 volts that we need for the Wiseblock. And first, let's drill an antenna hole for the connector, and then let's solder the Wiseblock to the battery terminals, and done. If you want to keep things super simple, you could be done right here. You could just screw the thing back together, connect via Bluetooth, and communicate through a decentralized network through a $7 lawn light. There are a few things that we could easily improve. We might as well use an antenna from an old 2.4 gigahertz router for Bluetooth so we can message from farther away. We can just get rid of this, drill another hole, and we're good. Now, if there's a huge downpour, I could see some drops of water getting in through these antenna ports, so let's put some silicon sealant around them. And while we're at it, let's use the empty space in the lamp casing to put a pair of 3300 milliamp hour batteries instead of this 1500 milliamp hour one, giving us 4.4 times more battery life to help us keep this thing on during a really cloudy week with no direct sunshine. And while we're at it, just in case we have a nuclear winter or you decide to use this indoors or something, we might as well utilize a battery holder with a USB charge port as a backup. We need to reverse the schematic and rearrange and resolder all these wires so the solar panel charge controller will be feeding into our new battery rig. And there you have it, a mostly covert, self-sustaining Meshtastic node for anywhere between 25 and 50 bucks, depending on how many of my luxurious add-ons you put into it. And if you bend the antennas down, it looks extremely inconspicuous. And when our solar lawn lights are banned because ICE found out that people are using them for encrypted off-the-grid communication, I am more than happy to participate in an arms race of how many common household items I can cram a comms setup inside. Now let's turn it up a notch. Obviously, mesh communication becomes more powerful when you can connect to more nodes. And if you wanted to drastically and quickly increase the range of your solar lamp, you could just mount it up in a high place, like next to a gutter or something. But I'm afraid that if you live in a rural or semi-rural area, that lawn lamp isn't going to cut it. So we need a 12-watt solar panel, a mount for the panel, a waterproof electronics box, a big-ass 915 megahertz antenna, an antenna cable, a Heltec Meshtastic device, and two rechargeable batteries offering around 7,000 milliamp hours. We don't really need to worry about extended Bluetooth connectivity because, remember, this isn't a Meshtastic user node, but a repeater node. I should only have to set it up once and then never bother with it again. Safely mounting and grounding an antenna is always a bit of a pain in the ass, but the rest was astonishingly easy, and I immediately picked up a whole lot more nodes in the southeast. And it's worth mentioning that my compound here is on top of a small mountain, and now I kind of want to build a tower up here that would connect all of Atlanta. Come to think of it, I'm going to put this on my videos to consider list for 2026. By the way, you don't have to use Meshtastic on this build. There's also MeshCore, which offers some advantages in efficiency and encryption at the expense of range and ease of use. If you wanted to use that instead, it's as simple as plugging the radio board into your computer via USB and changing the firmware. Unfortunately, there seems to to be a whole lot of astroturfing about this, because why the hell would anybody be able to enjoy anything on the internet? So it's actually really hard to find objective information between the two protocols. My advice is that if you're new to this and you don't already have a community of friends using it, then Meshtastic would be a great gateway for most users. If it's not working well, the default settings are not for everyone, and there's a whole lot of quick changes you can make in the app that drastically change performance. If you already have a bunch of people that you can locally connect to that use Mesh Core, then give that a try and ask them to give you the ideal settings for your area. Just remember, one is not superior to the other, and anybody claiming so is full of shit. The good news is that it costs you literally nothing to try out different protocols, and exploration is encouraged. Anyway, DIY Meshtastic devices would make a fantastic gift for just about anyone, anarchist or not, and hopefully one day when we've rejected mass surveillance, all of these flock cameras can become decentralized repeater nodes. But until then... I've spent a soul-crushing amount of time making videos on this channel covering flock safety's uncomfortable omnipresence and 50-plus security vulnerabilities, but one thing that I never really touched on was how to detect, log, and track hidden flock safety cameras in the first place. Fortunately, a hacker by the name of Colonel Panic, with the help of GainSec, had explored this and came up with a pretty amazing solution appropriately called FlockU that runs on a Wii Spy device, and it looks like this. It would truly be a controversy if I didn't have ESP32 featured somewhere in this video. ESP32 is basically a series of super inexpensive low-power microcontrollers with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth connectivity. Most of the libraries are fully open source, and for the few that aren't, there's a large community reverse engineering them to make it so. Depending on where you're getting them, ESP32 boards can cost as little as $5. Or for example, here's a 32-bit dual core board with an AI camera module that has object recognition built in. It also has a digital microphone, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and battery charging chip. This costs under $20. Generally speaking, if you have an idea for a portable, connectable device, 4 out of 5 times, ESP32 hardware will be what turns that idea into a functional prototype. The Wii Spy device is basically an ESP32 S3 chip with a buzzer and some custom printed PCB. It runs about $2,250 for the two PCBs and around $70 for the fully assembled device. And this is a bargain when you consider that, depending on what firmware you're loading on it, it could be a device that exploits Unitree humanoid and dog robots, or a radio direction finding device, or a fox hunter, or a drone tracker and identifier that can monitor and log up to 8 drones at once. And of course, a flock safety camera recognizer and detector that uses datasets of device IDs ranging from ALPR cameras to acoustic surveillance devices to detect and log them into a mapped database. And as one would expect, it makes a little noise when it detects a flock device, and it even has a heartbeat sensor to let you know your proximity to it while driving or walking around.
What? Oh, ha! There it is.
It's easy to set up, even on Windows. If you have Python installed, you just install Platform.io Core and then set up a virtual environment and then run a Python script that gets everything up and running for you. That actually sounds a little bit complicated, but it's really just like 2 commands and 2 clicks. Then you just head over to your web browser of choice and you have a GUI with various customizations and a map to keep all of your detected devices, which you can choose to share to larger databases like DFlock. You can mount it in your car, 3D print a keychain, hook up a larger antenna, or even buy a retro punk rock patch from Colonel Panic with one embedded inside it. I personally decided to go completely apeshit and print out a rifle-like handle for a directional Wi-Fi Yagi antenna that's connected to an alpha network card between the nozzle and the Wii Spy. Now, just to taper your expectations a bit, the flock detection isn't perfect, as the database needs to be updated to catch the most recent camera models, and obviously the device is typically not going to detect a camera until it's in range where it's already visible to you. But more importantly for this list, open ESP32 devices like this not only have plenty of alternate firmwares with new uses, but they're practically screaming to be customized. I can almost guarantee that my Wii Spy will be doing something completely different this time next year. Customizable hardware and open source is truly the gift that keeps on giving.
Let's chat about anarchism.
A frequent narrative with anarchism is a person or a group of people opting to not participate in authoritative rule that threatens their free will. So more often than not, historians refer to notable anarchist communities by how much of a problem those in power had with those communities. A wonderful example of this in history would be the Taborites. Back in the early 15th century, a famous philosopher and motivational speaker by the name of Jan Hus had some reformative ideas about the Catholic Church and was promised safe passage to Prague to share and debate them. And by safe passage, the Catholic Church meant safely tethered to a stake while being lit on fire. This pissed off a lot of Hus's fans, and they decided to move out to the woods and start a little town called Tabor, about 50 miles south of Prague. In this community, somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people, aka the Taborites, created the weirdest flags in history. They also decided that there would be no servants or peasants. Everybody would chip in and have the same opportunities. There would be no taxation, and there would be no property that wasn't collectively owned by everyone. This not only could be the first anarchist society, but the first communist one. The Catholic Church has notoriously never been one to vibe with societies not believing what the Catholic Church believes, so they ordered the Taborites to be drowned. The Taborites fended off not one crusade, not two crusades, but five crusades in what would eventually be known as the Hussite Wars. A cool 100 years after that, a slam poetry performer named Martin Luther was inspired by Jan Hus and Taborite ideas, and he literally pirated the Bible so unordained people could read it, which led to European Reformation, which more or less ended the Middle Ages and brought in the modern age. Anyway. So like most of us, sometimes you want to know if it's going to rain later today. So you take a quick peek at a weather site or app, and after sifting through nearly 50 megabytes of auto-playing videos, ads, and clickbait, you get to see this. Now, if you didn't want to see as many ads and garbage, most major weather platforms offer monthly or yearly subscriptions. But here's the thing. You already paid for this information with your tax dollars. And for the most part, private weather forecasting is just repurposing and monetizing data from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the NWS, the National Weather Service. Virtually anybody with an internet connection can freely access weather forecasts, warnings, maps, satellite imagery, and radar. If you have a weather fetish, you can feast your eyes on sexy things like convective outlooks and current mesoscale discussions. And it needs to be pointed out that the National Weather Service leads the world in forecasting and warning of catastrophic weather events and data acquisition and analysis. And NOAA is used as a vital asset for forecasting and research by nearly every country in the world. It's truly something that Americans can be proud of. So what happens if one day weather.gov or NOAA.gov is taken offline? Well, since virtually every commercial weather service relies on that data, they'd be bouncing between shared European data and the Farmer's Almanac. Or what happens if there's a mass power or internet outage due to a hurricane or some type of catastrophic weather event? Well, I have some good news. There are 15 NOAA imaging and research satellites hanging out in the sky. And in my case, for the east side of the United States, it'll be up there doing its thing for the next 15 years, whether your tyrannical government likes it or not. And the best part that way too few people realize is a thing is that you can access this data directly from the satellite for as little as $50 if you just want to hold an antenna and get a quick weather forecast, and closer to $190 if you want a permanent uplink that downloads high-resolution real-time data. And that data consists of everything from visible light photography of the entire planet to long-wave reflections to dust and wind analysis, and all of this is unlimited with no cell phone tower, internet, or radio license required. Okay, the first thing you need to do is pick out a satellite, and this is actually way more fun and less confusing than it sounds. There's a completely free and, frankly, incredible program called Skyroof where you can punch in your location, and it gives you a rundown of where they all are, what frequency they're operating on, and when and where they'll be accessible to you. If you're new at this, I'm going to recommend GOES, which stands for Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellites. The key word here is geostationary, meaning that you probably have one somewhere above your head, in the same spot, 24 hours a day, 365 days per year. The most challenging part of this whole project is going to be pointing a dish or antenna precisely at a satellite, so not having a moving object is incredibly convenient. But once you're comfortable with that process, there's a pretty wide range of satellites that you can track and scoop data from relatively affordably. For this video, I wanted to keep everything as easy as possible and relatively affordable, so I used a Nuelect GOES weather satellite bundle that I got for under $200. It comes with the dish, a pole mount, cables, a software-defined radio capable of reaching the required frequencies, and a filter and amplifier combo called the Sawbird Plus. And that little notch filter really does ease the amount of time you would spend tinkering or fine-tuning this project. Quite possibly the most important thing to consider with this project that unfortunately a lot of people take shortcuts on is that if you're planning on setting up the hardware indoors and then running the antenna cable outside, you're going to have a much lower signal to noise ratio. The filter or amp needs to be as close to the dish as possible, otherwise that long cable that you're running outside is just turning into a noisy antenna that the amp is amplifying that has nothing to do with satellites. I'm now realizing that this sounds way more complicated than it is when I'm putting it into words. I am running one powered Ethernet cable
outside from my computer, and then there's just a daisy chain of things going into the satellite dish. So it's actually very simple. What is not as simple is aligning the dish. Okay, so in my case, on the East Coast, the closest and most visible is GOES 19, which is just southeast of me. Head to dishpointer.com and punch in your address and satellite. Zoom in, and you'll be able to find a general idea of where you'll be aiming, which will help you decide where to put the dish. Obviously, you want to put it in a place where you have a clear line of sight view of the place in the sky where the satellite is, and write down these numbers and the true azimuth and elevation, as this will come in handy. I used a compass app called Compass. Make sure that you calibrate your phone or tablet first by doing the figure eight thing, and then match up your azimuth and elevation at the location of your dish. In my case, there was a squirrel's nest at the top of a tree just under where I needed to be aiming. At first, I used an RF spectral analyzer and then a portable SDR radio and wasted about an hour trying to lock in a signal. Do me a favor and learn from my mistakes, save yourself some time, and just get a laptop or an Android phone or tablet and have it run free software called SatDump, as it'll let you know your signal-to-noise ratio at that exact frequency. It's also obviously really handy to have the actual decoder you'll be running while doing the alignment, so you're not wondering if you could have done a better job later. Finally, we're ready to cook. We'll want to load up SatDump's UI, select your SDR, and punch in your GOES frequency, which is frequently 1,694.1 megahertz. Then you select your satellite in mode, in this case GOES HRIT, and keep an eye on the signal-to-noise ratio down here. Anything above 1 decibel works, anything above 3 or 4 decibel works reliably. Mine was actually pretty bad at first, but it still synced and downloaded images just fine. And if everything went smoothly, you'll be downloading high-resolution images and forecast data within a few minutes. I literally just let mine run overnight so I could build a time lapse. Beautiful. And if you get super into this and make a hobby out of it, spending a few $100 on a better SDR will give you a much lower noise floor and a higher bitrate, which allows you to connect to other modes that deliver more high-resolution images, videos, and measurements. And really, honestly, the reason that this is such a good gift is because it opens the door to software-defined radio, which is an absolute treasure chest of independently run projects and experiments, not to mention an instant and accessible gateway to explore the crazy and active world of modern radio. By the way, I posted a little clip of this to Instagram and got some messages telling me to check out Save It for Parts, which turns out to be a hugely underappreciated YouTube channel that is a goldmine of projects like this, primarily using objects that would have otherwise been discarded. And if like $200 is too much for you to invest right now and you really want to try this out, there are a whole lot of unused satellite dishes out there that people would love for you to haul off their property. Save It for Parts is the guy and YouTube channel that can show you how to set all that up.
Anarchism.
Back in the early 2000s, I was really sick of January in Chicago, and I had very few responsibilities and a brand new credit card, so I decided to drive to Guatemala, and I took an adventurous route, which led through a lot of morditas, which is a nice word for being stopped by corrupt police and negotiating a fee for your freedom. But there was nothing that could psychologically prepare me for being stopped at a roadblock and seeing a sign like this: Rebels. Jungle Rebels. Admittedly, I didn't know much about Jungle Rebels at the time, but I knew that it was probably not good for my life expectancy. The armed guards at the roadblock asked me where I was headed, and I told them that I was staying in San Cristobal, a nearby city, and they told me that the route on my map wasn't good and drew me a different one. And then they shook my hand and assured me that I was safe and told me to not be anxious about shopping or eating in rebel territory or asking questions, and they just asked that I remained respectful. Unfortunately, their reassurance didn't do very much to ease my anxiety, and I tried to get out of rebel territory as quickly as possible. And that is one of my biggest regrets in life, because I knew nothing about the Zapatista movement at the time, and I definitely didn't realize that I had traveled to an autonomous zone that didn't answer to the Mexican government or any government for that matter. The Zapatista Army of National Liberation, fueled by the experience of poverty and mistreatment of indigenous people, firmly rejected the North American Free Trade Agreement. This 300,000 plus member community didn't want to overthrow the Mexican government, they just didn't want to be part of it anymore, and they were prepared to fight for this freedom. The eight Zapatista principles are, in no particular order through my dodgy translation: don't command your community, obey it. Don't impose ideas, propose them. Represent your community instead of speaking for them. This one is the most difficult to translate and explain. Go down and don't go up, meaning that new ideas should always challenge traditional forms of power and take the most vulnerable into consideration. Any Zapatistas watching this, feel free to tear me a new asshole in the comments if I'm butchering this. Construction should always be prioritized over destruction. Everything for everyone, nothing for ourselves. And finally, we want a world where many worlds fit, meaning that you empower the community by recognizing
recognizing and learning from the struggles of marginalized individuals. It's also important to note that Zapatista communities have always refused help, aid, charity, or any dependence from outside sources. They view their complete sustainability as a vital role in their autonomy. Now, despite being a successfully functioning society without aid, state, police, or participation in global capitalism, if you asked a Zapatista if they were an anarchist, they would likely say no, because it's a European term and they have no interest in being defined by European terms. Fair enough. So in a region teeming with poverty, substance abuse, and drug cartels, even by national standards, how is it that this area of Chiapas remained one of the safest places in Mexico without a single police officer or prison? This is accomplished through community justice. If a crime is committed, there are three levels of appeal. Level one, the local community. If someone commits petty theft, vandalism, or something minor, an unpaid, temporarily elected community agent encourages all parties in the dispute to talk it out and reach a conclusion and a handshake. If there's a more serious crime or dispute that can't be solved locally, a regional group is formed from a rotating body of elected authorities to investigate the facts and propose a resolution. And if that's not working, you go to level two, a trial. There's no attorneys allowed, there's no court fees. The rotating body of authorities propose a solution that satisfies the victim and the community. And then sometimes level three, if needed, a punishment. Usually in the form of restitution, community service, or re-education, which consists of lengthy private communication with the elders, which I guess is kind of like therapy. And if you refuse your punishment, there's a lot of social stigma, which is actually pretty unbearable in a small collective community. And in the very rare extreme cases, the nuclear option is expulsion. You lose your place in the community and you are free to experience a terrible life as an indigenous criminal in Mexico. This sounds like I'm describing a peaceful utopia, but on day one of the Zapatistas declaring independence in 1994, the Mexican government deployed as many as 70,000 troops to Chiapas that used tanks and helicopters to bomb Zapatista villages. And after 12 days of this violence leading to enormous protests in Mexico City, they eased up but remained stationed surrounding the autonomous zones. And also, since the hobby of violently attacking defenseless indigenous villages comes with international outrage, the government started funding paramilitary groups instead that paid and armed other indigenous people in the region who carried out attacks on Zapatista communities. A lot of these attacks specifically were operations that assaulted women or burned crops. And in Actiel, the paramilitaries entered a church and murdered 45 pacifist Zapatista sympathizers while they were praying. Most of them were women and children. It took 23 years for the Mexican government to admit responsibility and apologize to the victims' families in 2020. Over the last two decades, constant ideological attacks in combination with unchecked cartel violence on open community centers eventually forced the dissolution of autonomous municipalities. In other words, as far as I can tell, the experiment's over, despite it kind of being successful. So a little bit of backstory is required. Every device that connects to a cellular network, and even some that do not, have an IMSI, which stands for International Mobile Subscriber Identity. A mobile phone network operator can triangulate and track the location of devices using this number, and to prevent misuse or even scarier stuff from happening, most of the time the provider issues a TMSI, or Temporary Mobile Subscriber Identity. So generally, if the police or ICE wants to track an individual on a cellular network like T-Mobile, they have to supply T-Mobile with a judicial warrant. And that judicial warrant requires probable cause that a crime has been or will be committed, and typically requires a complete context of the situation and specifics regarding what is being searched or tracked. It's just that when James Madison wrote the Fourth Amendment, he clearly wasn't taking police officers' feelings or convenience into consideration. But the Fourth Amendment gets really annoying for ICE agents, as being an undocumented person isn't actually a crime at all. It's a civil violation. As of November of 2025, over two-thirds of ICE arrests are of individuals with no criminal convictions. So what do you do when you've taken a job as an ICE agent and now have orders to detain people who aren't suspected of committing crimes? The best option would be to find a more respectable job, like a used car salesman or a lobbyist, or I suppose another option would be voluntary euthanasia. But if you're following tradition, then you'll use taxpayer money to buy devices that make phony cell phone towers that track people using their devices' IMSI. One brand name of such devices is Stingray or Kingfish, but there are plenty of options
options available from various vendors. They operate as a man-in-the-middle attack, such as the ones that I've highlighted in previous videos when hacking wireless routers. In this case, you're tricking people's devices into connecting to a phony cell phone tower by broadcasting a stronger signal than the real one, and in populated areas, this can amount to thousands of innocent people who are completely unrelated to your investigation being victims of the attack. Now, if you or I did something like this in America, we would be violating quite a lot of cybersecurity laws as well as the Federal Wiretap Act. But cell site simulators have been used for upwards of a decade by law enforcement and ICE, and just recently were reported to have been used on protesters. Technically, in many states, you need a warrant to use an attack like this, but many agencies can do it with only a court order, or they just do it regardless of what the Constitution allows. So sometimes you have to take things into your own hands. There are various operational mechanisms for IMSI catchers, but you generally use a high-power beacon to trick your phone into connecting. Then, they downgrade your connection to an older protocol. The older, the better. 5G generally has a lot of protection against this type of thing, although it's not perfect, and a really determined and well-funded agency could probably pull it off. 4G or LTE has some notable weaknesses, 3G has terrible encryption that could be decrypted in real time, and 2G is pretty much a free-for-all. Forcing individual users into these less secure protocols makes tracking them a whole lot easier. So if you're, I don't know, at a protest or you're a person of interest for ICE, and if you notice that you have a 4G or LTE logo, there's a chance that you're connecting to a fake cell site and being tracked. If you notice that you're connecting to 3G or 2G, that's really sus, and unless you're in an extremely rural area or somewhere you'd expect to be roaming out of network, I'd recommend shutting your phone off entirely. But I still get 4G and LTE signals all the time. How can I know whether I'm connecting to T-Mobile's tower or Fascist Mobile's tower? Fortunately for us, a whole lot of companies made a whole lot of portable data hotspot devices, and they essentially just act as internet routers for your Nintendo Switch or your laptop that can connect to your mobile network's data connection rather than a landline internet connection or Wi-Fi. Also, fortunately, most smartphones have this functionality built in already, so not a lot of people bought these, causing them to pile up on eBay for a small fraction of what they retailed for. And super fortunately, a lot of these hotspot devices were pretty poorly secured themselves, which enables them to be repurposed as really effective phony cell tower detectors. The EFF organizes and hosts various types of software to make this conversion as simple as possible. For my $20 Orbic, I had the option of using ADB, USB, or just connecting to the device via Wi-Fi, and I went with the latter. It only takes you a few seconds to flash the firmware, you reboot, and then you have a little line that turns green, white, or red, depending on the status of nearby cell connections. You can also connect to the device with a GUI and a web browser and edit the settings, even allowing you to send notifications to your actual phone or tablet if a cell simulator is detected. It's portable, it runs all day on a charge, and it costs less than a case of beer. Now imagine sitting across from your anarchist nephew on a holiday and explaining what this does as they open the box and power it on. They will talk about how fucking cool you are for the rest of your life. This one was a failure, probably due to my own lack of expertise. And one of the reasons why I'm including it here is that maybe it'll inspire somebody with that expertise to actually pull it off. That'd be awesome. So one of the things that I've been trying to do on this channel for ages is to make an accessible alternative to Spotify or digital music streaming platforms, like a Goldilocks zone of convenience, compatibility, artist support, owning the music you enjoy, and most importantly, being able to discover and listen to music on your own without an algorithm doing it for you. And there are so many devices and tools and projects available that this kind of sounds like an easy thing to curate. It is not. It is very much not. A lot of people who do this use an old computer or a mini PC and then use something like Jellyfin, or in unfortunate cases, MB or Plex, which has you paying a subscription fee to access your own files. In most cases, running a computer made for desktop use for a streaming music server is inefficient and not terribly reliable, and I'm just not satisfied with that solution. Even running a single board computer like a Raspberry Pi isn't great for this, due to the fact that the boards and storage are not meant to be on 24/7. But there is one type of inexpensive, always-on, and headless device that can run fairly complex operations. Wi-Fi routers. The goal was to get a $30 GLINET Shadow Travel router to run a Jellyfin server. I installed some OpenWRT firmware and quickly realized that the RAM limitations alone would push it too much to be reliable. So I upgraded to the $100 Slate X, which kind of has a similar ecosystem but with a quad-core CPU and 512 megabytes of RAM. A few excruciating eyeball-bleeding days later, after learning a whole lot about how routers work while trying to have a device access and launch Docker containers stored on a Linux-formatted high-speed USB drive, I realized that if I actually managed to get this to work, it probably wouldn't be the stable and reliable music server that I'm looking for. And even if I got it running and I told you to buy this exact router and give you the scripts to run, the setup process would be like 20 steps and involve you risking destroying the device. Sometimes you just have to admit defeat. What I did learn is that gl.inet, Glinet, I love it when you spend so much time reading about something or researching something and never speaking to another human being about it. And months down the road, you realize that you have no idea how to pronounce it. But what I did learn is that Glinet routers are incredible for people who want to tinker. I definitely tried experimenting with my own firmware builds, and I bricked the router in the process. At one point, I literally thought it was on fire. But there's a whole alternative recovery boot mode that tries to save it and allow you to go back to stock firmware, which worked like 4 out of 5 times. But even when my dumbass pushed this device past the point where even the recovery mode wouldn't work, to my utter surprise, the user manual has a pinout of the board, which has available JTAG and UART connections, which means that I was able to manually write the stock firmware back onto the system BIOS memory chip. I simply cannot emphasize how much cooler and less wasteful the world would be if the FCC or FTC required every electronic device to have documentation and open access like this. So even though my little travel router hosted music streaming idea took a shit, this still could host media on local networks, or more importantly, easily operate as a super customizable VPN tunnel, ad blocker, or Tor router. All of which happen to be ways that anarchists like to browse the internet without their data and identity being mined for profit, so it kinda does make it to this list. I suppose it's the only currently available mass-produced line of consumer products to do so. And it's worth pointing out that I don't have any sort of relationship with the company, I'm just really horny for products that make it easy for me to modify or repair them.
Anarchism.
When the average Westerner thinks of anarchism, they think of fire, overturned vehicles, and broken windows. And while those associations are not necessarily wrong, they do require context. A good example of how context changes everything would be the case of Casey Goonan. He is accused of trying to firebomb an empty federal courthouse in Oakland during a protest. Now, it'll take you quite a bit of searching and reading between the lines to learn that this firebombing amounted to igniting a Molotov cocktail in a concrete planter near the building, destroying a shrub. He also lit a bag of Molotov cocktails on fire near a police vehicle, which may have contributed to the vehicle being burned, as apparently everybody and their mom was lighting cop cars on fire that night. Fortunately, Casey's antics didn't lead to anybody being injured, but this type of arson in California, if it leads to property damage, is punishable by 16 months in prison, and fines are up to $10,000. And Casey pled guilty to malicious damage or destruction of property by fire or explosive. But since Casey is a self-proclaimed anarchist who was protesting the Israeli occupation of Gaza, prosecutors called him a domestic terrorist, and he was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment in a specially designated communications management unit with restrictions on visitors' phone calls and even communication with other prisoners. Maybe you're thinking what I'm thinking. It seems like over 18 years of Casey's 20-year sentence is for his beliefs, not the inarguably dumb shit that he did during the protest. Another California man received a 20-year sentence for his violent actions outside of a government building at a protest, David Dempsey. Dave sprayed a police officer with pepper spray, beat him with a flagpole, and stomped on his head over 5 times among a long list of attacks on multiple law enforcement officers at this protest. And he pled guilty to these charges, but since the riot he attended was at the Capitol building on January 6th, he received an unconditional pardon and is enjoying his freedom without a single demerit on his criminal record. The difference between these two cases, other than one person causing property damage and the other person causing injury, is entirely up here. One was on the right, one was on the left. Violent patriot, violent anarchist. And the irony is that if you strongly agree with me that this is a malpractice of justice, then you are guilty of the same crime that added 18 years to Casey Goonan's sentence. The crime of having a philosophy that dissents from your government. My goal here is not to justify violence, or even lighting shrubs on fire, nor is it to convert my viewers into anarchists, or even identify as an anarchist myself. I just want you to more frequently question and recognize the absurdity of institutions in your day-to-day life, because it can only benefit you to do so. I suppose this whole thing has gone on long enough, but I learned so much while making this video, and I hope some of y'all learned something from watching it. And if you couldn't tell, I love bundling things together in videos like this because a person who's looking for information on mesh-tastic solar lights might be even more interested in using an SDR to pull data from satellites, or might be an expert in network hardware development who can get Jellyfin running on a router successfully. One can hope. If you want to see more videos like this and support this channel and project in general, my Patreon offers loads of released and unreleased music, sound design assets, audio production assets, and a big old friendly community. In just the last year, my Patreon members have almost exclusively enabled this channel to be able to conduct and explain research that is impacting legislation all over the country. And now that the end of the year is here, anything that doesn't carry over into future projects will go to charity. And you can join for as little as $1. Thanks for watching. Keep creating. Bye.